I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest Simon Winchester writes in his new book, The Pacific is an Oceanic Behemoth of Eye-Watering Complexity. His new book is titled Pacific, and it's about the oldest and biggest sea in the world that covers one-third of the Earth's surface. It's the most seismically active and most biologically diverse ocean, and its weather systems have global effects. It's also the site of potential conflict today in the South China Sea, an important trade route where China is creating islands and building up a naval presence. Simon Winchester writes about all of this in his new book, as well as surfing, coral reefs, atomic bomb testing, and much more. It's structured around 10 important events involving the Pacific Ocean since 1950 and looks ahead to the future of this vast body of water. And Simon Winchester joining us once again on Radio Times. Last time we were talking about the Atlantic. Now we're talking about the Pacific. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me quote something that you write near the very beginning of your book. You say, much of the dirty business of the modern world has been conducted within the confines of the Pacific.
It is extraordinary, really. We've been the Europeans since the 16th century when Balboa saw it, then Magellan crossed it, or nearly, except he was killed in the Philippines. And then what have we done? We've colonized it, we've brutalized the people, we've disrespected them, we've overfished, we've polluted. So our record, I mean, this book isn't a totally unremittingly gloomy book, but the record of European and American penetration into the Pacific Ocean, which hitherto had been a relatively peaceful place of, you know, blue skies and blue waters and palm trees leaning into the trade winds, is not a pretty record. And many of the chapters do cover the environmental depredation and the destruction caused by such things as atomic bomb testing. So our record isn't very good. It's not something to be proud of.
In fact, what you seem to be saying is that after Pearl Harbor, the U.S. began to pay much more, for obvious reasons, much more attention to the Pacific. We had an enemy over there in Japan. But until then, our eyes looked eastward.
Yes. It's a complicated story. But basically, our relationship with all of the countries on the western side, and since 1857, when Admiral Perry opened up Japan, or forced Japan to open up, and then our relations with Korea and our complicated relations with China. I mean, just consider one oddity, that I was watching the movie The Sand Pebbles the other day with Candice Bergen and Steve McQueen about this American gunboat operating in the Yangtze and rescuing some missionaries 1,000 miles up from the sea. They did so with total impunity, and so did the Germans and the Italians and the French. They just operated boats in the middle of China. And if any of their sailors committed any offence, they were tried not by the laws and the courts of China, but by the laws and the courts of the United States, this principle of what they called extraterritoriality. Imagine if the Chinese operated gunboats up the Mississippi and one of their sailors got into a fight in Hannibal, Missouri, and said, no, I don't want to be tried by the people in Missouri. I want to be tried
unheard
by the court.
It,
unheard of. And yet this was the way we treated the East, that they were somehow inferior. It was racial, obviously, our attitude, and that has characterized an awful lot of what we've done. But since the end of the Vietnam War, I mean, certainly, of course, things changed after the end of the Second World War, but after the end of Vietnam, most of the Western powers started, for one reason or another, to withdraw. The British, who had vast control over the Pacific, withdrew. Our last one was Hong Kong. We left that in 97. Now all we have is Pitcairn Island, with the bounty mutineers were. And the only Western colonial power of any significance in the Pacific today are the French, and their rule is generally rather benign. But now we're leaving the Pacific, as it were, to stand on its own 2 feet. I mean, not before time. They were standing on their own 2 feet very happily until we came along in the 16th century. And now, at long last, they seem to be creating for themselves a Pacific identity, no longer tainted by European or American influences.
Well, let's talk about one of those acts of impunity, which was the testing of nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands, the island of Bikini, for instance. And in fact, we're going to play a clip of one of those testings. But what's so interesting is why these islands and what it took to get the people off those islands.
So cynical that was. I mean, it was invoking the authority of the Bible. I mean, basically, the islands, and another aspect of Western interference is that missionaries had found out into places like the Marshall Islands, and these people who were animist by persuasion had no particular interest in any god of any kind, and they just did their quotidian routines of, you know, fishing and mending their nets and harvesting coconuts and so forth. All of a sudden, they were told, you've got to be Christian. And so they had, instead of being naked, which, why not, they had to wear muumuus and Mother Hubbard dresses and look frightful, but and to know the Bible. And then to drop bombs, or to test bombs, the Americans came along and said, well, we can create a pillar of fire, much as the pillar of fire you may remember from the Bible that the Israelites followed as a sign from God. Well, we can create pillars of fire too with these new amazing weapons. We're testing them. So that's a sign to you that you should leave your island and let us do the work of God for the good of all mankind. And these islanders said, well, yes, if that's the work of God, we'll leave. And they left and we destroyed their island or irradiated it so that it's uninhabitable today. It's a monstrous thing to have done.
Well, we quote her from the book of Exodus, and you quote one of the, leaders on this island. We didn't feel we had any other choice but to obey the Americans.
Yes, because the word of God had paramount authority.
Well, let me play a clip. This is actually some declassified footage of one of the nuclear bomb tests in the Bikini Island. We're not exactly sure of the date, but just to get a sense of the American stick-to-itiveness and what happens afterwards.
A bombing crew was competitively chosen. Major Swancutt, the pilot. Major Wood, the bombardier. The B-29 Dave's Dream would carry them to the target. The bombing plane is nearing the target with its escort of photographic planes. There's the target. Bomb away.
There it goes. The fourth atomic bomb has been successfully detonated. First you see a blinding flash, then comes the hemispherically shaped cloud that expands rapidly just behind the initial pressure wave. After the smoke clears, the characteristic mushroom cloud begins to form and shoot skyward.
You can hear that and you can also see it. I mean, you know, anytime you see a nuclear bomb exploding, it's just a ferocious sight.
Isn't it? I mean, the later ones, I mean, that was one of the relatively early ones in the late 1940s. The once they had developed the technology for thermonuclear weapons, the biggest of all was March the 1st, 1954, the so-called Castle Bravo test. That, the column was 25 miles high, and the mushroom cloud, they by now translated it into, because it was much bigger, into the cauliflower cloud, and that was 60 miles across. Mm. And the amount of radioactive fallout from it was prodigious, and it all, because the wind had changed 36 hours before the test, fell on two islands called Rongelap and Rongerik, where there were inhabitants. And they were, first of all, this material looked like snow, and they sort of thought it was snow. They'd heard about snow. And so it was falling from the sky, and they picked it up and started licking it and tasting it. And, of course, they were terribly ill within a matter of moments. But astonishingly, the Americans saw all this from their warships using binoculars. And they said, you know, this is a golden opportunity to study these people, the first human beings to suffer potential radiation poisoning. And so they left them there for 2 days, getting sicker and sicker and sicker, until someone in Washington said, wait a minute, well, this is cruel, this is abominable. And so they were eventually taken off the island, but many of them were terribly ill as a result of what had happened. Interestingly, though, about the Bikinians, which is an island near Rongelap and Rongerik, and which was more or less totally destroyed by the 23 bombs that were dropped on it. Those islanders, the ones that were persuaded to go by this invocation of the Bible, were sent to an island called Kili, which is in the very south of the Marshall Islands, where they've been ever since. And the savage irony for them is that the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands was in London 2 weeks ago, pleading with the British government to allow these people to be resettled because, guess what? Their island is being flooded because of rising sea levels. So it's a double whammy for them. Their home has been destroyed. They've been irradiated. They can't return to where they came from. The island that they were sent to, which has no coconut trees, no dock, no lagoon, it's a miserable dump of a place, is now being inundated by rising sea levels. So they've had a miserable life, and it's all our fault.
Our fault, meaning the U.S.'s fault. And obviously this naive and sort of shocking disregard for people, for nature, the effect of what they were doing. I mean, this was after Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes,
so they had to have known to some degree the effects of these.
Yes, but I mean, the extraordinary thing in the specific case of Bikini is that that test, the Castle Bravo test, was conducted by a man called Alvin Graves, who himself had, in the experiments at Los Alamos, had survived a very serious accident and had been very seriously irradiated and was nearly dead, but he recovered after a year's treatment in hospital. And the extraordinary psychological change that Alvin Graves underwent, he went around saying, oh, if you're a big man, if you're tough, you can survive radiation poisoning. And yet this weird cavalier attitude that he had, which is, of course, biologically completely illogical, allowed him, of all people, to be made director of the test program. And when the wind had changed such that it was likely to irradiate these people on Rongelak and Rongerup, he said, oh, well, if they're tough people, they'll withstand the radiation. Press the button. And so they pressed the button, and this titanic explosion happened, and all these people fell grievously ill. He's a man, I mean, there are many villains in this story, and he, to my mind, is one of the worst.
Well, you also write that now divers come to, what, Bikini, looking for sunken ships, I guess, right?
Yes, because the principal plan of the Bikini explosions was the most vulnerable aspect of the military forces was thought to be a ship, because soldiers can run and hide, aircraft can take off, but a big aircraft carrier, let's say, you drop a nuclear weapon on it, it can't scuttle away, it sinks. So they had an array of targets, and actually the clip you played, they had a ship called the Nevada painted red and with a big white cross on it to suggest this is the center point. They missed it by about 700 yards, and so it didn't sink. But a number of them did. They had about 50 ships in the lagoon, and the second bomb was better in that regard. They sunk more ships. And so nowadays these ships are festooned with strange living creatures, corals and so forth, and so elite divers go to the Bikini Lagoon to get sort of brownie points, really, to say, well, I've been to Bikini, which is a very difficult place to get to. So a lot of very famous people go there, very rich people, and go diving on the wrecks that we created.
And do they have risks for contracting what people living on that island possibly, or those neighboring islands contracted?
They have to sign waivers like you wouldn't believe. I mean, hugely long documents saying this is a radioactive area, don't dig in the soil. Because the people, the Bikinians, were briefly brought back in 1978 and they were so happy to go back. But then they planted lettuces and things, and the lettuces were found to be filled with radioactive cesium. So the American government said, whoops, we miscalculated. You'll have to go back to this miserable place called Kili, which is where they've been ever since. So the divers are told, eat the food on the dive ship, don't go ashore.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Simon Winchester about his new book. It's called Pacific, and I will give you the subtitle maybe twice during the hour. It's a long one. Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. We'll be talking about just about all of that in the subtitle after this very short break, including surfing and Hawaii. We'll take a very short break. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Simon Winchester is our book. We're talking about his new book called Pacific. He's also the author of several other books, so one about the Atlantic Ocean, The Professor and the Madmen, The Men Who United the States, The Map That Changed the World, The Man Who Loved China, A Crack in the Edge of the World, among others. And again, we are talking about his book about the Pacific Ocean. We spent the first portion talking about the destruction of these islands, Bikini, of course, most notably. So let's talk about the rise of surfing, something else that has its roots in the Pacific Ocean.
Much
and
more,
Hawaii, right?
Yes. Well, first of all, Tahiti, generally. That's when most people think that wave riding, as it used to be called, the standing up on these immensely long boards, which were the early surfboards were 21, 22 feet long. I mean, can you imagine they weighed a ton? I mean, not literally, but almost a ton. And that spread fairly rapidly to northwards to Hawaii. But once again, when the missionaries saw it, because most of the Hawaiian men and women surfed without any clothes on, which seems to be a perfectly idyllic thing to do. They said, no, you can't do that. We're shocked that you're...
These missionaries.
Oh, dreadful people. Well, I shouldn't say that, but I think many of them are. So they made them... The choice was you either surf fully clothed or you don't surf. And so the Hawaiians said, well, this is ridiculous, we're not going to surf. But the only people who did were children. But children in Hawaii in the early part of the 20th century surfed enthusiastically. And they were encountered one day in 1907 by Jack London, of all people.
Of all people.
Of all people. He was sailing on the Snark across the Pacific, stopped in Hawaii for a few weeks with his wife. And one afternoon in Waikiki, which was then a little village, they were swimming. And suddenly he was overtaken by these adorable little children who were on little tiny surfboards called Paupo, skimming along the waves. And he thought, my gosh, this is wonderful. I want to learn how to do that. And so he persuaded some locals to teach him. And he was a big lumbering old white guy, and he didn't do very well at first. But then there was this sublime moment when he managed to stand on the top of a wave and rode it into the shore, twisting and turning, and landed without injury on the beach. And he was transported, literally and figuratively. And so he wrote a piece for the October 1907 issue of the Woman's Home Companion, of all magazines, saying surfing the king of sports. And suddenly that piece was then syndicated in the Pall Mall Gazette in London and in a magazine in Australia. Surfing then was created as a sort of circum-Pacific sport. So Redondo Beach and Huntington Beach in California, Bondi Beach in Australia became meccas. And then something else happened, but that was half a century later, when in cinemas in Long Island, not in Manhattan, but in, because Columbia Pictures weren't very confident about their new movie, the movie Gidget opened. And that story of this young 14, 15-year-old girl triumphing on the waves became an overnight sensation, and suddenly surfing entered the social mainstream in America.
A perfect setup to our clip. This is from the 1959 movie Gidget, and this is Sandra Dee as Gidget with the big kahuna played by Cliff Robertson. This is the 1950s. Let's give it a listen.
I was looking for Stinky. I got the money for my board. Gosh, I can hardly wait to try it out.
You dumb at surfing?
No, not too much. Yesterday was my first. Boy, was it ever exciting. It was like nothing I ever felt before. Whoop, we were on an elevator, headed for the sky, and then zoom, speeding across the ocean on top of the world. It was the ultimate.
The big kick, huh? Sounds like you're a gunner, kid.
And what a way to go.
That's so hilarious.
It's beautiful.
And charming.
And charming, but yeah. The lovely thing about it is that it's a true story. It's the Kathy Kona was her name. And father wrote a book about this little child, effectively, learning with these great big boys to how to master the waves and become an addict. And, of course, the film itself, highly saturated stock, all the ladies in, very pretty young women, but wearing bikinis which covered their navels, because in those days, of course, we didn't have navels, or you guys didn't anyway.
Right.
And the film is a transport of delight, it really is. But the wonderful thing from my point of view is that Gidget herself wrote to me the other day, and she's Kathy Zimmerman now, and she lives in Malibu, and she still surfs. She's of a considerable age, and 2 days a week she works in a bookstore, and came across this book and read it, and read that there was a chapter that begins with her story, and she found my email, emailed me, and we're having lunch.
Oh, that's
so
terrific.
I'm having lunch in early December
with Gidget
in Malibu. I couldn't be. Whatever this book does, the fact that I'm going to meet Gidget is a wonder to me.
Are you a surfer yourself? Did you try surfing?
I'm a hopeless swimmer, so I'm terrified.
No, you don't like to swim at all?
I really don't. I'm not very good. I mean, my wife sort of says, come on, the water's fine. And I said, well, actually, I'd rather just sit and look at it and write about it.
Well, that's so interesting because, as I said before, you've written a book about the Atlantic, now this book about the Pacific, which takes up a third of the Earth's surface, and yet you don't swim.
It's extraordinary. I mean, I also sailed right across the Indian Ocean in a 30-foot schooner for 6 months, and I stroked my 8 at Oxford. So I've lived in the water. But like a lot of deep-sea fishermen who, I mean, I can swim, I just don't like to, but they can't swim. But their view is that if your boat overturns in the middle of the sea when you're fishing, there's no point in trying to survive because you won't.
So why don't you like swimming?
I don't know. Something happened.
Just don't enjoy it?
No. Well, I don't. I just remember. I mean, you should be a shrink. But I remembered vividly fishing with my father one day and standing with my back to the river in my Wellington boots, and I fell backwards into the water with my feet up on the bank and me, my head under the water, and it was terrifying. And my father didn't notice me, and I couldn't get up. So I'm sure that's
near
the reason.
Drowning?
I was drowning, yeah.
How old were you?
Four.
Oh, you were
four
really
a
little guy.
Yeah, a little guy. So I don't stay away from the water. I love the water, but get me in it and get me swimming across it, and I don't want to.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I'm not his therapist, just so you know. Simon Winchester is our guest on Radio Times, and we are talking about his new book. It's called Pacific, and it is about 10 specific events that he pulled out and writes about related to the Pacific Ocean. And again, you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You do write about the Pacific garbage patch, the problems of acidification. You mentioned the fact that there's sea level rise. Of course, it's around the world, but nonetheless having its effect on the Pacific Ocean or certainly part of the Pacific Ocean. Is that a body of water at risk? It's just so huge. It's sort of hard to imagine it being at risk at all.
Well, that's a very interesting question because, yes, in parts it is at risk, and the people that live in the low-lying islands like Kiribati, which also has this unique status as being the only country that It stretches across the date line and across the equator. So Kiribati is at the same time summer and winter and today and yesterday, all at once. But it is very, very low-lying, and it will be inundated, many of the atolls, by the end of this century. And so Fiji has offered them sanctuary. They've put aside 6,000 acres where they said the people from Kiribati can come and live. So in pockets, as it were, if I can put it like that, the ocean is in danger. But the extraordinary thing is it is such a vast heat sink because water absorbs the heat from the sun. And so, which is why the Pacific is effectively the weather generator for the world, because everything that goes on, the atmospheric circulation, the patterns that cause El Nino, which we're about to start, have a triggering effect for the weather in the other parts of the world, not just the savage weather, not just hurricanes and cyclones, but also snowfall patterns in Europe and California and drought in Africa and that sort of thing. So weirdly, because the Pacific absorbs so much heat, ultimately it'll probably be the savior of the planet, not us, human beings. And that is something we tend to forget. And you must cut me off if I get boring about this.
No.
I mean, there are two things to say. For instance, this is something I discovered when I was writing the book on the Atlantic. There is a creature called Prochlorococcus, which is a tiny single-celled algae which lives in the warm waters of all the oceans. It was discovered in 1989. Before that, we didn't know it existed. It is the most numerous creature on this planet, and it produces oxygen. It absorbs carbon dioxide and it produces oxygen. And one in every five breaths that you and I will exchange in this studio today comes from the generation of Prochlorococcus, a creature we didn't even know existed until 1989. The thing is, it loves warm water. So the warmer the waters get, warmed, of course, by carbon greenhouse gases, the more of them there will be. Its range will extend. So the more carbon dioxide it will absorb, the more oxygen it will create. It will, as it were, purify the world that we are bent on destroying. And so this is all part of the James Lovelock's Gaia theory. It's the world is a self-regulating entity. We will be the victim of our stupidity. We'll disappear in 100, 500 years. But the planet will recover. And things like Prochlorococcus and the ability of the Pacific to absorb heat is what will save the planet. So the planet will go on, but we won't.
You said we will disappear in 100 to 500 years.
Well, my professor at Oxford, Jim Kennedy, very distinguished man, believed that we would no longer be here after 100, 150 years. Not 150,000 years, but 150. Mm. Because we'll blow ourselves up with these weapons that we've created, which, of course, were tested in the Pacific. And you can see it beginning. I mean, I lived in India for a long time. There is bound to be an exchange between India and Pakistan. All those weapons in
Pakistan.
And they
have nuclear weapons.
Both of them. And the Pakistani weapons will probably be taken by the Taliban. I mean, we have made terrible choices and terrible trouble for ourselves. So whether it's 150 or whether it's 550, it's a measurable and short period of time. But the planet will exist for a long time.
But so I expected you to say it's because of climate change and overpopulation. I mean, I'm thinking of all the other stressors on the planet and human population. You're saying we're just going to blow ourselves
well,
up.
Well, yes, and other factors as well. I mean, for instance, there was a big fuss created the other day when the Chinese announced that they were going to abandon their one-child policy and allow people to have two or more children. But what has the effect of the one-child policy been? Well, the principal effect is because the Chinese have traditionally disrespected girls, if the girls are the child, because they won't have little boys there, as we all know and are horrified by. And I used to see it when I lived in China, girl children either aborted or drowned or, you know, dumped in the Yangtze. It happens, which means there's this huge number of young men in China. China is brimming with testosterone at the moment. And so the nationalistic arguments that the Chinese are employing, and which I talk about in this book to a degree, are being fueled by a lot of nationalistic, militaristic young men who have nothing better to do now because they don't settle down with families and behave like, you know, regular people. They want something to do with all this energy. Mm. So, I mean,
they want to fight?
They want to fight. A lot of people, I mean, my wife is Japanese, and we're well aware now of the growing hostility once again between China and Japan, which is another subset of the problem. So we are creating, we are hoist on our own petard, if you like. We create these inventions, we enact these policies. They're very short-sighted, and we are reaping the whirlwind now.
I do want to talk about, because you do have a chapter in here about China and the South China Seas, but let me just roll it back just a little bit, because you say the eruption of Pinatubo, and this was in the Philippines in 1991, basically got rid of Clark Air Base, the Subic Bay Naval Base, and that created this opening for China to begin looking at the South China Sea and, I guess, the trade area or the trade path there as a way to exert its muscle.
It's one of the unintended, unexpected consequences of natural activity, this gigantic volcano. And I covered it in detail because I studied geology at Oxford, and so I was interested in volcanoes and had covered the Mount St. Helens eruption. So I was on a sort of milk run between Hong Kong and Manila for the fall of President Marcos, and so Manila became relatively familiar to me. And so when this eruption happened, I thought, yippee, it's another great story to be covering. So watch this huge explosion. But what I didn't realize was that it would cover Subic Bay Naval Station and Clark Air Base, which were 20 and 9 miles away from the peak, respectively, with thick, greasy mud, which effectively rendered them inoperative. And Dick Cheney, who was then the Secretary of Defense, ordered them both to be closed. And so all of a sudden, all the ships that had patrolled the South China Sea and all the warplanes that had patrolled the South China Sea went back to Guam and to the bases in Okinawa and Tokyo. And the superintendents of the South China Sea, which had hitherto, since the end of the Second World War, been largely American, disappeared. There was a vacuum. And so what did the Chinese do? Well, there was an admiral, he died 3 years ago, called Liu Huaqing. And Liu Huaqing was actually initially a soldier in the People's Liberation Army. He became a general, but then he transferred to the Navy in his late 30s and became an admiral. He was a formidable intellectual. He was also a diehard communist. He was a very tough man. He was the general in charge of the forces at Tiananmen Square on the 4th of June, 1989. Wow. So you don't mess with this guy. He developed a naval strategy for China, which was basically in four parts. Take possession of the South China Sea. And then there are a group of imaginary island chains extending out from China into the deep water Pacific. And progressively, over the next 20, 30 years, until the key date of 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, allow Chinese naval ships to be patrolling as far east as Hawaii. And the first step of this was put into place and has been put into place now with the situation in the South China Sea.
Hmm. You talk about these imaginary islands. I mean, it is creating what, land masses out of coral?
Well, two different things. In the South China Sea, there are these little coral reefs, many of them submerged. There's a group called the Spratly Islands in the south and the Paracels in the north. What the Chinese have been doing very stealthily, very carefully, but with an eye on the future, because they don't have this four-year cycle that we do in the West. They can long-range planning. That's what China's all about.
Sure.
And so they said, well, look, on this little coral reef, we'll build a lighthouse, and on this one, we'll build a radar station, on this, we'll put a little dock, and on this one, a little airstrip. And we'll do it one at a time, so no big American warship is going to come along and tell us not to do it, because that would seem so disproportionate. And so about 5 years ago, the Pentagon woke up to the fact that the South China Sea was now a patchwork quilt of little Chinese possessions, with airstrips, with docks that could accommodate destroyers and runways that could take bombers or fighters, certainly, and lighthouses and radar stations. And so they have effective control. They haven't used it in a malevolent way, but they control the South China Sea. And the next step are these imaginary island chains, which aren't real islands, which are bastions of protection off the Chinese coast, one stretching from Japan to Indonesia, the next one stretching from Kamchatka to Australia, and the third from the Aleutians via Hawaii to New Zealand. And the Chinese Navy is edging its way. It's fully operative now within the first island chain, second island chain by 2030, the third island chain, in other words, Hawaii, by 2049. And the admirals in the Pentagon are going crazy.
Well, and we're almost up at a break here. Do you then see some kind of a conflict? I mean, certainly it could lead to trade wars or a conflict.
It could, but I don't think so. I don't think the Chinese have that in mind. They have a totally, they say, all we want is maritime equivalence. You Americans have run the Pacific. Well, we're big and powerful now. We want to be able to run our ships just as you have. We have no malign intent. And unlike you, we didn't colonize people. We didn't go into, you know, California, and we didn't go up the Mississippi. So we have no ill intentions. We just want equivalence. And that is going to cause problems, because you could get some hot-headed sailor, you could accidental collision. It's dangerous. But I think America needs to calm down about it.
That's Simon Winchester, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Pacific, Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. We're covering a lot of that subtitle there. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Covering a lot of territory in this hour of the show. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Simon Winchester. And in his long career as a journalist and as an author, he's written about volcanoes and earthquakes, maps, the history of the dictionary. His new book is titled Pacific, and he structures the book around 10 moments in history since 1950 related to the Pacific Ocean and all the countries that have their borders on the Pacific Ocean. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499, or you can just sit and listen to us, which is just fine. A tweet from Victoria I just have to read to our listeners. She says, this interview on WHYY Radio Times is terrifying in a very calmly British way. He's saying people will be off the planet within 150 years, which you did say.
I did. And this is the view of many paleontologists who think that just like ammonites and dinosaurs and brachiopods, we'll soon be fossils and people will, or interplanetary travelers or whoever comes to the planet Earth, will wonder why we lasted so little time. And the answer is that we did ourselves in, I think.
And we began our conversation talking about the nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands off of or on top of Bikini. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see that as the sort of beginning of our end?
I think it's one of the processes. I mean, there are so many nuclear weapons around. It's criminal folly. I mean, the bomb that I fixate on is this thing called Castle Bravo, which was the biggest bomb that the United States ever dropped on anyone, tested, which was 50 megatons. And that, when you consider the destruction, I don't know if you've ever been to either Nagasaki or last year. I mean, that weapon was 25 kilotons. I mean, this, we're talking orders of magnitude bigger. I mean, it can destroy unparalleled numbers of people and lay waste to huge tracts of territory. And we don't need them. We really don't. I just wish, personally, I mean, this doesn't come into the book, that a country, and it has to be America, really, that says, you know, we're going to get rid of these weapons. Mm. It's just monstrous that we have them. We've got, 1,400 bombs in their arsenals. The Minutemen, we've got the submarines and so forth. We shouldn't have them. I mean, and if we keep them, we are going to use them. Someone's going to use them, and then we'll rue the day.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about North Korea, certainly North Korea today. You have a whole chapter about the Pueblo incident, which I remember so well. This was 1968. Set this up for us, and we do have a little news clip that I do want to play just a couple of days after the boat and the people on board were taken by the North Koreans.
Yes, the Pueblo was an unattractive little ship built for the army initially, but then taken by the Navy and manned by members, you know, sailors, but also with a core of NSA employees in locked bunkers within the ship. And its role, it was based in Yokosuka in southern Japan, and it was sent out in early 1968 to wander along the North Korean coastline to listen to chatter and to the people decoding the various messages that the North Koreans were sending to each other. And it was on the, I think, the 21st of January, 1968, it was arrested. I mean, there was a firefight. Captain Lloyd Buka, who was the chap in charge, many criticize him for allowing the ship to be captured. I mean, you're supposed to scuttle the ship or destroy it or fight to the bitter end or whatever. Anyway, it was captured. His crew was captured. The ship now is a tourist attraction. It's in Pyongyang. It was initially in the port of Wonsan, which is on the eastern side of the Korean Peninsula. Then it was taken into Pyongyang itself. And I've been to it because I've been to North Korea several times. And it's weird. It's you go on as a tourist attraction.
But it's tiny.
It's a minute ship. It's very unimpressive. And yet it's still regarded by the U.S. Navy as a commissioned warship in service, but temporarily out of commission. You know, been 50 years, but anyway. But the crew were subjected. One of them was killed, and the rest of them had the most terrible time. You know, torture and beatings and interrogations and humiliation. But then there were negotiations to release them, and they were in for nearly 11 months before they were released, just before Christmas in 1968.
Well, let me play, and this is a newscast shortly after the Pueblo was taken. This is reporter Bill Downs, and talking about the U.S. Pueblo being captured by North Korea.
What are the options? One is a blockade of the port of Wonsan, seeding the bay with sonar, pressure, acoustic, and other new mines. But a blockade would also trap the USS Pueblo. An amphibious landing or raid to free the Pueblo's crew would take months to prepare and might not come off. There also has been talk of a reprisal air raid on a North Korean target, but the Vietnam experience argues against this. It would be a fairly simple operation to seize North Korean shipping that use the supply routes to Haiphong, but the communists are unimpressed by hostages. And finally, there is the so-called unthinkable option, America's nuclear weapons. Washington's Democratic Senator Henry Jackson said today that if ground fighting breaks out again on the Korean Peninsula, then the United States would be forced to use tactical nuclear weapons because American GIs cannot be mobilized quickly enough to save the situation. So, all the military options carry built-in perils, including the ultimate danger of World War III.
And again, a report just a couple of days after the taking of Pueblo talking about World War III.
It's extraordinary, and yet the one unremembered irony of this whole situation is that North Korea was created by an American.
Tell that story.
May I tell it?
Please do.
Really quite extraordinary. One of the delights of writing a book like this is that you discover so much that you've either forgotten or never knew. 1945, 14th of August, in the Pentagon, two young colonels, Charles Hartwell Bone Steel III, this wonderful
I'm trying
name.
Not to laugh.
No, you did laugh.
I did. I muffled it, but yes.
And Dean Rusk, who you will remember, he was Secretary of State in John Kennedy's administration. They're young colonels in the outer office of George Marshall, the chief of army staff. They're listening over the shortwave radio to Emperor Hirohito across in Tokyo announcing the surrender with that marvelous phrase, the progress of the war has not necessarily gone to our advantage, I'll say. Mm. And so we're surrendering. And so Bone Steel and Rusk said, well, that's the Japanese problem finished. Now the real problem is the Soviet problem, because the Soviet Union had joined the war only a week before and was now racing through Japanese-held territory, Sakhalin Island, Manchuria, the Korean Peninsula, and seizing it all. And that made Washington suddenly fearful that we were going to get a Soviet Japan, we were going to get a Soviet Far East. this had to be stopped. So the progress of the Soviet forces had to be arrested. Where are we going to stop them? And they had a 1944 copy of the National Geographic on Bone Steel's desk, and he had a map in it. He took it out. It was Japan and the North Pacific. And he noticed that Seoul, the capital of Korea — Korea at the moment was, of course, a Japanese colony — and the old capital, Seoul, and San Francisco were almost exactly on the same latitude, 37-40 north. Why don't we see if they'll stop just a little north of Seoul so that we can control Seoul? How about the 38th parallel? And they drew with a Chinagraph pencil a line on this geographic map, which still exists. You can see it in Washington. Yeah. They took it into George Marshall, and he said, yes, 38th parallel, it's got a ring to it. So let's see if Moscow will agree. So they told state told Moscow, and Moscow said, yes, actually our chaps are getting rather tired. You know, the mosquitoes in Manchuria at this time of the year, and the tanks keep getting bogged down in the mud. We'll stop at the 38th parallel. So they appointed Kim Il-sung as their sort of local leader. We, the Americans, appointed Yi Sing-man, Sing-man Rhee in the south. And two countries were effectively created, North Korea and South Korea, which then went to war in 1950. And the DMZ, the most fortified place on earth, divides them to this day. But the extraordinary irony, and we're talking about the arrest of the Pueblo, is that when the Pueblo sailors were finally released just before Christmas 1968, they were brought to the Bridge of No Return, the crossing point at Panmunjom in the DMZ, and they were marched one at a time across this bridge away from the miserable lantern-jawed communists and diet of unremitting turnip soup and so forth, into the waiting arms of the Americans, who offered, you know, big smiled, tanned Americans with steak and orange juice and Christmas and freedom and all this good stuff. And each one was greeted by the general commanding all forces in South Korea, the now no longer Colonel General Charles Hartwell Bone Steel III, the man who had created the whole mess in the first place. Because think, if he hadn't drawn that line, yes, perhaps the Soviet Union would have taken Korea. And Korea would, like Vietnam and Cambodia, where my son lives, and Laos, have been a modestly impoverished communist state. And communism would have worn out its welcome, as it has in most places in the world. And yes, Korea would not be the prosperous place that South Korea is today, but it would be united. It wouldn't be two divided places at each other's throats, requiring 30,000 American soldiers to be on duty there.
But it also tells us about a certain time and perhaps, you know, the American use of power, which is that you can take a map, draw a line, create two countries.
Astonishing, isn't it?
It is astonishing.
But I mean, we, the British, are the past masters at doing that. We have created so much mayhem around
the
world.
There's much we have learned by from
the art. Well, I'm afraid you have. You haven't learned from history. None, nor did we. And we're therefore condemned to repeat it.
Just to finish the Pueblo story, the U.S. apologized, right? Was that part of the deal for the release of the...
Well, it was, but it was a very cynical apology, because everyone knew that 24 hours after the apology, we would take the apology back, which is what we did. In fact, I think less than 24 hours. That was part of the deal, and the North Koreans knew it. You'll apologize on paper, but then once the men are free, you'll say, well, actually, we didn't mean it.
You also include, and you talk about the fact that these crewmen were starved and tortured, including a man who had surgery done on him. You included his description in here, without anesthesia. I'm not sure what they were doing to him, but he says, I can still recall the scissors cutting away flesh, being sewn up with sutures that looked like kite string, and he goes on from there.
He does. It was horrifying, and it's a dreadful description, and painful to write, painful to read.
Yeah.
But he got over it. I mean, he did survive. And I'm not sure whether he's still alive, but a few years ago when I was living in Hong Kong, a number of members of the Pueblo wrote to me and said, we think it's time for everyone to say, calm down, let's go and see our old ship, let's go back to North Korea. So I went to see the head of the American Bureau in the Korean Foreign Ministry in Pyongyang and asked whether this might be possible. Well, it turned out not to be in the end. But I remember taking two North Korean diplomats to lunch in New York and to try and get the ball rolling. And they were these very well-dressed, very good English-speaking. They were obviously spies. And they ordered – I always remember that I ordered, went to an Italian restaurant called Orso on 53rd Street. And I ordered a risotto. They ordered the truffle, white truffle of the day risotto, which 5 years ago was $75
a
plate.
Sure.
They had the greatest luxury they could afford. And always the whole time outside the restaurant, there was a car with two FBI guys sitting watching us and also wondering what I was doing.
And what were you doing?
I was trying to plead for them to allow the Pueblo crew to go back to Pyongyang. That's all, honestly.
Is it hard to get into North Korea?
Not really, no. But I had a British passport. I still do, even though I'm an American citizen now. And you just, when living in Hong Kong, you go to Macau, take the hydrofoil to Macau, go to the Korean visa office there and pay. I think you've got to pay about $150 a day in advance for the number of days you're planning to spend. So if you're spending 10 days, $1,500 will get you a visa. Then you fly up to Peking and there's a daily flight Air Koryo where they serve Coca-Cola on the flight.
But do you see, I mean, we hear about the terrible poverty and starvation. Do you see that when you visit North Korea?
Well, when I went, I was quite a keen runner. And I used to, obviously, they have a minder who would follow you everywhere, but he didn't get into it. He was running, first of all, in his suit alongside me, whereas I'm in my little Nike shorts and things. And I would zoom past him, and finally he'd give up and go back to the hotel. And so I was able to run into some of the outer suburbs. But Pyongyang is a Potemkin city. It's not a real, only the privileged members of the party are really allowed. It's pretty grim. And it looks like, the worst imaginable slum in an industrial city in northern Europe. But you get out into the countryside, and for instance, when I would go out to Wonsan or some of the cities in the northwestern part on the Sea of Korea, you see pretty primitive horses and carts and pretty emaciated-looking horses. And people, miserable beyond belief, and the footage we've seen smuggled in from the Chinese border shows
horrifying.
Oh, it's so horrifying. Yeah, it's really it's a bad situation. But can you imagine the difficulty of the countries reunite? I mean, that's going to be extraordinary. I mean, it makes the East German West German reunification look like a vicarage tea party. This will be a mess.
Well, let's end on a high note, and this is this Hawaiian sailing canoe. I don't know how to say the word in Hawaiian.
It's Hokulea, which is the Hawaiian word for Arcturus, that very bright star we see in the sky. And she was built in 1976, and as Hawaii's gift to the bicentenary. And it wasn't just the physical construction that was the gift; it was that they were reestablishing the ability to navigate this beautiful 60-foot-long canoe without any navigation aids at all, with no compass, no sextant, and, of course, no GPS.
Right.
And so they had. There was one man in the world that knew how to do this, a chap called Mao Piaoluk down in Satawal Island, and they flew him up to Hawaii, and he said, yes, I can navigate this canoe. I'll teach young Hawaiian men how to do it. And they navigated successfully and totally accurately across the sea, 2,500 miles to Tahiti. And then they learned how to do it. And Piaoluk himself died. He was an elderly man anyway. And now, on May the 14th last year, there are now 300 young Hawaiians who know how to do this, to navigate just by the stars and the pattern of seabirds and clouds and the feel of the sea through the hull. And they're navigating around the world. And so they went, starting from Maui on May the 14th last year, easily to Tahiti, and then they turned right and went to Samoa and Tokelau and the Cook Islands, spent Christmas in New Zealand, went across to Australia, entered now a new ocean, the Indian Ocean. They crossed that. They went to Christmas Island. They went down, and a week ago they arrived in Mossel Bay in South Africa. You can follow them, hokulea.com. They're now going round the coast, round Cape Agulhas, Cape of Good Hope, heading out into the Atlantic Ocean. And I think this will be so moving. To me, I'm very moved telling it. They aim to go up the Potomac and see their Hawaiian president to show what they can do and what they've done. And then after he, as it were, blesses them, they'll go down the east coast of South America through the Magellan Straits, just as Magellan did in 1529, nose out into the Pacific and head back home for Hawaii.
Such an inspiring story. Simon Winchester, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
Lovely for us as well. And again, the book is called Pacific: Silicon Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer today. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.